And you're very welcome to another episode of the STEM Inspirations podcast, brought to you by the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition. John Loftus with you, and we have a series of episodes that will be very interesting to you, I think, brought to you all the way from Valentia Island in Kerry. And why is that, you ask? Well, the very first successful transatlantic cable ran from Valentia Island in Kerry, and we're going to meet some people over the course of the next few episodes that will bring you loads of background information and the history of what is a foundational moment in the world of technology and communications. And the first person we're going to meet is Michal Lynn, and Michal is chairman of Valentia Island Development Limited, and he is a director of the Transatlantic Cable Foundation. He's also a historian, and that foundation is making huge strides at the moment in trying to achieve UNESCO heritage status for the Valentia and Transatlantic Cable Station down in Kerry, because if you think about it, it is the cornerstone of the world of communications that we enjoy today. But Michal is a very interesting character, so the next 40 minutes I think you will definitely enjoy.
My name is Michal Lynn. I'm chairman of Valentia Island Development Company, and I'm also a director of the Valentia Cable Foundation.
We're at a very historic site, has been dubbed the eighth wonder of the world. Why is it so significant?
Well, I suppose when the cable was laid across the Atlantic, it really started globalization as we know it today, because before that, telegraphy was advancing. It started back in 1835 and that way, when they were developing the railways. And by the 1850s, they were able to communicate from London all the way east as far as Moscow, Istanbul, and St. Petersburg. But to the west was a no-go area. There was the Atlantic Ocean. It was 2,000 miles wide and 2 miles deep. And nobody ever thought that you could put a cable across underneath that. So when the cable was laid eventually, after several attempts, it reduced the time it took to send a message across the Atlantic from about 2 weeks by boat. And of course you waited 2 weeks for your answer to come back. It reduced that down to about 2 minutes. That was very significant, because first thing it did, of course, is it connected the two greatest stock exchanges in the world, New York and London. And it is reckoned that because of the transatlantic cable, world economic activity was increased by 8%.
My goodness.
Yeah.
That is some impact.
So it did have a massive impact, you know.
Let's go back to who came up with the idea in the first place.
There was a guy called Gisborne who was planning to lay a cable across Newfoundland and across the strait to Nova Scotia, and of course you had the landlines then going down to New York. So he was he became bankrupt because he was trying to stand poles across Newfoundland. The territory wasn't very good, very rocky, and of course it was frozen for half the year, and you had people trying to go down to thick ice, you know, and he became bankrupt. And someone introduced him to Silas Field, who had become a millionaire at that time in the paper business, and he wanted Silas to help him to do what he was doing. But Silas saw the bigger picture, and he said the idea was, of course, by Gisborne, was that when ships would come across the Atlantic, he would take off the messages in St. John's in Newfoundland and send them by land all the way down to New York. And that would reduce the time it took to send a message to America by 4 days, which was considerable at the time. So Cyrus Field said, why send a ship to Newfoundland to send a message by land down to New York when you could put a cable all the way from New York to Kerry, Valentia, or whatever, Europe. So he began to investigate that, and the first person he went to was a fellow called Maury, who was head of the American Navy. And he said to Maury, he said, have you ever done any depth soundings in the Atlantic? What am I facing there? He said, and what sort of depths and what sort of terrain? And he said, what you have between Newfoundland and Ireland is a big plateau. It's made, he said, for your cable.
Perfect.
Now, he said, it's 2 miles deep, but you go north or south of that plateau. And he said, it's much, much deeper. He also got the British Navy to confirm that, you know. And of course, to the present day, the fiber optic cables follow the same line.
Is that right?
Fast forward a little bit, and how come Valenta in Kerry got picked?
Very simply, I suppose, it's probably the nearest point, but also because of the Knight of Kerry. The Knight of Kerry was the landlord of Valenta, Peter Fitzgerald. Peter was an MP. And Peter would have been writing to all the top brass in London.
So all this backing came on board for this mammoth project. You mentioned earlier on a number of attempts were made to lay the cable, but not to great success.
No, 1857, they started laying the first cable from the White Strand beside Carsbean out the back of Business Island. Because there was no point in laying a cable across the Atlantic if you couldn't send it on to London. So there was a cable laid across the Irish Sea in 1852, I think. And then there was one later from Donaghadee to Downpatrick. So London was contactable by telegraph from here. 300 miles out, the cable broke. Broke because when they went off the shelf and went to very deep water, the cable was flying out and they couldn't control it. The braking system wasn't good enough because of the weight of the cable, and it snapped. So they went back and they came again in 1858. This time, on the 5th of August 1858, the Agamemnon came in to the back of Bayness Island, brought the cable around Bayness Island and into Knightstown. Same time the Niagara arrived into Trinity Bay, and they started sending messages across the Atlantic. Unfortunately, the messaging was very slow because they had an awful lot to learn about cabling at that stage. Electricity was in its infancy. They didn't realize that when you send a message over 2,000 or 3,000 miles, that so much is leaking out. They had insulation, got a perca, but it wasn't 100%. So by the time the message got to Valencia, the signal was very weak.
Mm-hmm.
Because the signal was so weak and the needle was only flickering, it was very hard to say, is that A, is that X, is that B, what is it, you know? So a lot of the time it was repeat, repeat, repeat. So Whitehouse, who was the electrician in charge in Valencia, he started booting up the current, and one time he got a big battery from the Slate Quarry, and it ended up with Queen Victoria sent a message to President Buchanan, and it took 16 hours to send. So he burned out the insulation, and that was the end of that in 1858. But then they had an inquiry by the Board of Trade in London, and about all the great scientists of the world together. They wanted to investigate why did the cable fail and could it be done. The first thing they said is, we must define the units of electricity. They weren't defined before that. So they defined the units of electricity, and they defined the watt current, and then you had the ohm or resistance. So now they were all talking the same language. The other conclusion they came to, of course, was that not only was it possible to lay the cable, but with proper planning, it could be a success and it would last for a long time. The copper they were using was not pure copper, and they didn't realize that it made a difference. So from now on, they'd have absolutely pure copper. And if there was a break, they could pinpoint exactly how far away it was, you know.
Very good.
And that made an awful difference. The other thing that happened, I suppose, after, say, 1859, 1860, was Lord Kelvin developed, Thomson's name, he developed the mirror galvanometer. Now, if you receive that message in the dark and put a light behind it and a mirror and reflect it on down to a wall there 50 feet away, my finger moves a millimeter, it moves a meter.
Of course, yeah.
It was very easy to read. So you could read it 10 times faster, and you didn't need to increase at a much lower voltage.
So we get to 1966. Numbers of attempts, as you said, have been made, but they're still being driven to do it again. This our green knight is still riding forth.
Yeah, and mostly Silas Field, was the man really. He was the man driving it.
Yes.
He had spent a fortune on it, of course, but he still had investments, and he was a very persuasive character, I suppose, because he would have gone to Gladstone in the 1860s and that, and to look for money, and he was finding it hard. But that Board of Trade investigation figured that it would be the ordinary people would be able to buy shares in it, and they would be successful, and they would make money in it. So he bought a ship, of course, the Great Eastern, for an extraordinary little amount of £25,000.
That little?
Now, it cost, when they built the Great Eastern, they had to launch it sideways into the Thames.
Okay.
Because it was too long, it would hit the other side, the bank over the other side, before the bows would be gone in. So they had to launch it sideways, and they were only going maybe 10 feet a day, and brought in steel from all over England. It took them 3 months to launch it, and it cost £170,000 to launch it. It was meant for taking passengers to Australia. It was a disaster. She was very big, 692 feet long. And she had more disasters following her. They were traveling out by the Isle of Wight the first day with her, and there was a big explosion in the tanks, steam. And you know what happened? They had built up the steam, and somebody forgot to open the stopcocks, and she just blew. So lots of stuff like that was happening to her. And she was put up for auction. And one of the big shipping lines bid 50,000, and she was worth about 100,000 at least, and what you do with a big ship that's losing money, so she wasn't sold because of the reserve on it. So then 3 weeks later she went up again, and this time they put no reserve on it. So some fella put up a bid for 20,000, and Silas Field said 25. So he had his ship.
Excellent.
And they took all the cabins out of her, and she would take the entire cable in the one go. And that was a stroke of luck, I suppose, So
we finally had a successful transatlantic cable then.
We finally had it, we had two of them together, because they lost the 1865 one 600 miles off of Newfoundland. And they tried hauling it, but the grappling hook, they were grappling it with hooks at the end of 100 fathom hawsers, and they had 25 of those, and they were joined together by U-boats, and a chain is as strong as its weakest link, and never more true than in this case, because as they were hauled up, the hawser was holding, but the hooks were breaking. So they came back triumphantly, really, in 1865, because they were now doing 8 words a minute. They had James Graves back in Fylehamrum in the hut, and they were talking to him all the time. He was doing 8 words a minute, and they knew they could grapple this thing from a depth of 2 miles. So they went again in 1866, and this time without a hitch. They went straight in 2 weeks. They went right into St. John's.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And then they came back out, of course, 600 miles, and they picked up the 1865 cable after about a month at it. It took them a good while. But they picked it up, and Silas Field put a message on it, on the ship, 600 miles up Newfoundland, into Fylehamrum. They jumped out of bed when someone saw the light flashing on the 1865 cable. And he sent a message to his family in New York, back along the 65 cable, and out along the new 1866 cable, which by now was joined on down to New York. So they had two cables, they had a piece on board, 600 miles of it on board, the Great Eastern all the time. They made a splice there and they took that into St. John's, and they had two cables now working.
And as you said, the impact on the world
was immediate. Extraordinary, really, yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about what used to go on here in the cable station.
Yeah, it was, I suppose the operators first came from, mainly a lot of them from London, because they worked in the telegraphic business, sending messages, you know, originally sending messages down along the railways, for security on the railways, that's how it started. And then, of course, sending messages overland. So they were experiencing the Morse code and that, you know, so they came here to train. They knew people coming in. So there were people from London and a lot of them from Manchester and from Scotland and even some from Newfoundland, you know. And as the years went on, I suppose, they trained, they were training, it was on the job training and in the Morse code. And the numbers got bigger, I suppose. There was other cables laid, 1863 and 1865 and 1881 and 1884, I think. And then there was a German, the Germans were tired of sending messages to America through Britain, because it was the old system, you know, like they had later in the telephone, you know. You say, this is Dublin or whatever, give me Killarney, give me, if you were going to get through to Valencia, give me Killarney. Hello, Killarney. And Killarney would say, put me through to Valencia, and they'd put you through to Carsevine, and Carsevine put it. So this was the only they were doing with telegraphic messages. But the Germans decided to lay their own cable in 1881.
Right.
Now, the British cut it in 1914.
Of course it is. And where did that cable go? Where was that, that German cable?
That came from Munich all the way to into Fyleham Bay and the other end of the island.
Oh, right, okay.
And came down along the road down to here.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's it. When they had a hut, a wooden hut first in 1865, they built it, I suppose. But then in 1866, and they laid a successful cable. But within, then they built a stone structure the following year. And the year after, they built this place here, the main center of the building where you come in the front door. And so from 1868 on, you had the building here. And they expanded it in 1880 and 1920. There was another wings put on the back. And you had, they built 23 houses there attached to it, and the single men bachelors were living upstairs. They had rooms, and they had a sitting room, bedrooms, maybe six bedrooms in one block, sitting rooms having that, and the kitchen. And then you had other blocks in the different parts of the building they built out the back. And you had reading rooms and libraries, and doctor had a room up there, and there was doctor especially for the cable workers. Yeah, they were well paid. They were like same wages as a bank manager at the time.
My goodness.
So by 1920, you had up to 220 people working here.
My goodness.
That was a massive number.
Huge employer for this island.
Huh?
So a huge employer for this island.
Yeah. And big wages, and can you imagine the difference it made to the shops? The locals were coming in and putting stuff on the slate until the fair day, and the graffers, as they call them, would come in, and they had plenty of cash, you know.
So you mentioned the role, the operating role already, but what other roles would have been here? What are the roles would people have fulfilled here? Would have been engineers or?
I don't think you had engineers because they were always You had cable, people experiencing cable joining. James Graves, the first superintendent, he was here for 41 years in that office up there at the top. And I spent 41 years in the same office 100 years later. But that's a different story. Yeah, James Graves was recognized as the world expert on cable jointing, you know. So if there was a break in a cable anywhere across the Atlantic or even different places, I would say, around the world, maybe he would be asked to splice them, you know. So, and then you had electronics people and electricians, you know. You had, and of course, you had an engine room out the back that generated their own electricity. You had electricity here in 1930, whereas electricity didn't come to the island generally until 1959.
Right.
And all the front there was lit up with street lighting, like a little city kind of, you know. And every house had electric lighting back in the 1930s.
My goodness.
Which was unheard of. Every one of the houses had a maid to keep the houses clean and that was a great opportunity for young girls leaving school at the time, because otherwise they'd have to immigrate. And of course that had a knock-on effect insofar as the women hadn't immigrated, and so I suppose it led to maybe farmers getting married and raising families in the island and maintaining the population, you know. So, and then of course all the farmers back the island brought down a horse rail of turf every Saturday to the houses here. They also brought potatoes and vegetables and eggs. My mother bought a small farm, she said, on the money she made on eggs before she got married.
Wow.
She came from a farm, and they had her own hens in that farm. She didn't inherit the farm, her brother did. But she bought a 12-acre farm of land from the money she made in supplying the cable station with eggs.
Who'd have thought, when they were laying that cable, the impact that it would have on ordinary people's lives?
Yeah.
You know, we talked about the macro impact there a while ago, but that's the real kind of microcosm of the impact here on local life on the island.
Every one of them had a sailing boat, and there was regattas there every Saturday in the harbour. They had a cricket, they had a football field back here where they played football and cricket. And you had a 9-hole golf course up in Dunleen for them, and they had tennis courts, 2 tennis courts out the front, one on grass and one on whatever, concrete, you know.
Must have been an amazing buzz around the place.
There would have been, yeah. There would have been. And then you had, of course, the kind of cosmopolitan effect on the village, insofar as you had the English accents mixed with the Kerry accents. Nobody took too much notice. And, it was easy to recognise the local from the graffer.
Mm-hmm.
The graffer would be the man with the umbrella and the top hat and the shiny shoes. And the local would be the guy with the hobnail boots. Yeah.
So how long was the station in operation?
It operated from 1866 to 1966. Now, before 1966, it was going downhill. It was on the cards, it was going to close. Technology had superseded it, you know, and it was going to close. So they closed Newfoundland and Valentia on the same day. And in Valentia, Western Union auctioned off all the equipment. A lot of people bought it for the copper and for, you know. And in Newfoundland, they closed the door and they kept everything as it was. And then they turned it into a museum, and it's still there today. And 10 days' time, there's a delegation from Valentia, Kerrygan Council, and the department going over to Hearts Content for 4 or 5 days to talk to the people over there and to plan the road ahead from here on in. Like, you'd have to farm, it's a one application, and Valentia are taking the lead on it. The reason Valentia are taking the lead is that Newfoundland have several sites. They put up a site every year, whereas Ireland has only 2 sites, Skelligmichael and Brunabona, and then you have Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland. So Valencia would be treated much more leniently, or we'd get more urgency, you know, for nomination. And that's how it goes. And it's a transnational application. It's the one application. So the management committee that will be in charge would be, there'd be one management committee running both sites going forward, you know, to see that the both sites are kept properly and, you know, they don't fall into decay or whatever.
Of course, yeah. But it would be a wonderful thing to accolade to get.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, and then Kerry would have two sites within eyeshot of each other, you know, it's Killymichael and this, yeah. So, yeah, it'd be great.
Big bragging rights for the rest of the country.
Like, they reckon that on average there's about 15 to 20,000 visitors, UNESCO visitors, we call them, people that go only to UNESCO sites. Like, people would say, they'll take the family maybe to three sites in Britain this year, or next year they might do five sites in Italy, because Italy would have an awful lot of sites, you know. They go around from site to site like that, you know, and they're kind of specialised in it. It doesn't necessarily have to be the summertime or fine weather, you know, it's kind of an all year round. So, yeah, I think it'll be a big boost.
It's a fantastic story, and I think probably a lot of people around Ireland still might not know it. And the exhibit that you've got here, in a new interactive exhibit, is definitely worth visiting. So, what would you say to people that haven't been down to see the Valencia cable station?
Well, I suppose it's a wonderful story, and I think you'll agree it is very well told, and it's a part of Irish history, really. And they would say that it was where globalization started as we know it today. It made the world a smaller place. Now the entire world was interconnected, you know. Before that, as I said already, London could contact as far as Moscow, but and then they went across the Mediterranean in the early 1850s, so you had contact there with Africa, and that they had haphazard contact with India, I suppose, until the British laid their own cable eventually. The first cable that was laid there wasn't a great success and was breaking down all the time, and you had a language problem as well on one side, and but generally the whole world, after laying this cable, the whole world was interconnected. Later they laid cables across the Pacific, but of course they could go the other way before that, yeah. You know, my granduncle was laying the longest cable in the world from Vancouver to Fiji, I think, you know, so that's way back.
And is that where you got your interest in getting involved?
Oh, sure it was, no. I would always be interested in history. I did six books on Valencia back in the 70s and 80s, and then I picked the best of those in 2019, and I published a hardback. 370 pages on the history of Valencia and the history of the cable and the history of the Slate Quarry and football and rowing and everything really to do with Valencia. So I would have an interest in it. I became chairman of Valencia Island Development, and then UNESCO fell into our lap insofar as Al Gillespie, who's from lectures in a university in New Zealand, he was in Tralee one time, and he said to Mary Rose Stafford, he said, she asked him if some project in Tralee would be a success for UNESCO. Now, he had been a rapporteur for UNESCO previously, so he said, no, I don't think that would be a success. But he said, what would be a success, he said, is the transatlantic cable. Straight away she got in the blowout of Valencia. And the rest is history, you know, we picked up the project straight away.
Brilliant. Well, listen, we wish you all the very best in your efforts to get UNESCO Heritage accreditation down here. There'll be a great big party, I'm sure, if it comes to fruition. Let's say when it comes to fruition. But you know, in the meantime, it's well worth for anybody who has a modicum of interest in history and telecommunications, and just a real snippet of what this island played a part in back in the early days of telecommunications. Definitely well worth coming down to, and it's beautiful as well.
That's for sure.
Michal, thank you very much.
No problem. You're welcome.
What a very, very interesting man. And as we said in the podcast, if you make your way down to Valentia Island and to enjoy the interactive museum and experience that they have down at the Transatlantic Cable Station, then you will not regret it. It is very, very interesting. And it's a brilliant place to go for a couple of days as well. So that's it from this episode of the STEM Inspirations podcast. We'll be back with more from Valentia Island in the next few weeks. And in the meantime, don't forget the entries for BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition 2024 are about to close, so get your entries in now. You'll find all the details on our website, btyoungscientist.com, and we'll also be opening up our primary schools competition as well to get the budding young scientists involved. So check all that out on the website, and we'll see you on the next one. In the meantime, stay curious.